This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm David Brancaccio.
After financial markets nearly froze up in 2008 and 2009, triggering the Great Recession, new rules were put into place to keep Wall Street from ever again taking the sort of risks that would require a government bailout. With the new administration in the wings, the pendulum could swing back. A top agenda item for the new team is deregulating Wall Street. For just about the last 4 years, Jack Lew has been the United States Secretary of the Treasury. Secretary Lew, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, David.
What do you think? Is there room now for some deregulation of financial services and financial markets?
You know, David, I think you have to start by remembering how far we've come. In 2007, 2008, our financial system was in terrible shape. We were surprised by a financial crisis that led to the worst recession since the Great Depression. And it led to the most expansive overhaul of our financial regulatory system since the Great Depression. Now, where are we today? Today, we have financial institutions that have deeper capital, and I think they're the best capitalized financial institutions in the world. We have transparency where we used to have opacity so that complicated financial products will in the future not be some mysterious box of potential exploding problems if a financial institution hits a speed bump. In 07, 08, the uncertainty of what was inside those institutions was an accelerant to the financial crisis. We have procedures in place to resolve failing institutions so the taxpayers should never again have to step in and become the equity holders of financial institutions. There are living wills to govern how the largest institutions would work out. So I think before one asks what could change, we have to remember how far we've come. And, you know, in a bit of humility, recognize that until tested in a financial crisis, we don't know whether what we've done is as effective as we think it is. I hope that it proves itself correct. The fact that there hasn't been a financial crisis is not a reason to unwind what we've done. We built this system to withstand a shock that hasn't come and happily has not come on my watch, but will come because there are cycles and shocks come. I think that if you look at the questions that people raise often about where reform might be debated, one issue is small banks. And I think there's very broad openness to thinking about treating the smallest banks differently from large ones.
Some of them feel that the added regulation is onerous.
So we have a lot of flexibility, and that flexibility has been used to not have a one-size-fits-all approach. But the problem is when people advocate for small bank special rules, they sometimes jump exponentially to a size of institution that meets no definition of small. So, for example, under the Dodd-Frank law, there's a threshold of $50 billion for the size of an institution that you pay a certain level of scrutiny to. If there were a debate about raising that from 50 to 100, I think reasonable people would probably find a way to agree that there are small institutions that should get some special consideration. But the last major proposal put forth to reform Dodd-Frank didn't go from 50 to 100. It went from 50 to 500. And at $500 billion, you're talking about some of the largest financial institutions in the country. So reform, it has to be incremental and sensible. It can't be painting with such a broad brush that we undo some of the basic protections we have. I'll tell you the one thing I'm most concerned about in the short run. I actually am pretty confident that because it would take 60 votes in the United States Senate to do major changes to our financial rules, that there will be kind of careful consideration and caution, except in the area potentially of budgetary changes where a simple majority could suffice. The last remaining tool that a future Treasury Secretary will have if there is a financial crisis is something called orderly liquidation authority. Because under our budget rules, there's an assumption that at some point in 10 years there will be a crisis, you can theoretically save money by repealing that authority. What would happen if it got repealed? It would mean that there would be no way to help a failing financial institution to work itself through a crisis. And the way the provision works is it's a quasi-bankruptcy kind of proceeding where a kind of financing can be put in place to keep an institution from failing.
That would make you nervous if that were done away with.
Well, I have to tell you that it is the one remaining tool after Dodd-Frank that that the Treasury Secretary and bank regulators collectively have in a crisis. So I would approach that with extreme concern if there were proposals to repeal that. The other two things that come up with some regularity are proposals to look at the Financial Stability Oversight Council. We're having the last meeting for this administration later today. And some people want to roll it back. Before the financial crisis, there was no place where all of the regulators sat down together and looked across the whole financial system to ask, where are the financial stability risks? They would ask questions about the safety and soundness of individual institutions, but not about the impact on the whole system. There are some authorities that give the Treasury Secretary, as chair of that body, the ability to pull the regulators together, to pull information together, so that you can see what's coming. I think to take down the radar so that the next crisis would not be visible would be a very, very big mistake. You know, the third thing that you hear on a number of occasions is that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau should be modified. I think if you go back to the financial crisis, at the root of the crisis in 07, 08, was consumer abuse. It was abusive lending practices that got people into mortgages they couldn't afford and institutions investing in those products into untenable financial straits. Now, it was both a problem for the consumer, and that manifested itself in millions of people losing their homes or going underwater. It obviously manifested itself across the economy in a financial crisis that is second only to the Great Depression as an economic downturn. I think it would be a grave mistake to roll back the protections we have in that area, both because I think consumers warrant that protection, but also because financial stability demands it.
Among the things with the CFPB that you were just mentioning, though, is that it's not just independent, its critics say. It's really independent. Congress doesn't have the usual power over the purse strings, and the director hangs out for a long time. You think maybe too much independence?
You know, I think it is very much like the Federal Reserve Board in terms of the way it's set up and funded. It's not unlike the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in terms of how it's set up and funded. It's basically set up as a bank regulatory agency, which is supposed to be independent to some degree of the political process. It's one of the reasons why coordinating amongst the financial regulators is so hard. Their independence is important. It's highly valued. But there are areas where they need to share information and work together, which is why I think you need both an independent CFPB, but also a mechanism where a Treasury Secretary can coordinate across financial agencies.
You are a person who spent a lot of time working with other countries to prevent the next financial crisis from happening. Group effort, I think. Some political scientists think that going forward, the U.S. is going to act more independently from other countries. What are the implications of this for financial stability?
I think I would actually, before I got to financial stability, I would ask, what does it mean to the economic and security well-being of the United States? I think if you look at the world economy and the role of the U.S. in the world economy since the end of World War II, our leadership role in the global financial system has been an enormous source of economic strength and security. Let me give you a few examples just from my tenure here, which is the last 4 years, and one could tell a much longer story going back farther. When we wanted to respond to the extreme economic need in Ukraine after Russia's invasion of Crimea and eastern Ukraine, there was a need to fill a fiscal gap that was $20 to $30 billion. You could not go to the Congress of the United States and get $20 to $30 billion, even though there was almost unanimous support to give Ukraine an economic lifeline. Working with the IMF, the foundation for an economic package for Ukraine, which includes massive reforms to their policies, massive reforms so that decades of corruption are redressed, and economic assistance to make sure that they don't run out of economic runway before they run out of geopolitical runway. The IMF is the foundation for that, the International Monetary Fund. It's almost $20 billion of support. We've done several billion dollars of loan guarantees, which cost the American people hundreds of millions of dollars, and gotten $30 billion worldwide of support for Ukraine. The leverage that comes from that is important economically because it gives Ukraine the ability to have gone from a recession to growth. And it's important geopolitically that the United States can play a leadership role, put its flag in the ground for things that are, we believe in the sovereignty of borders very deeply, without having to go to the American people to pay all the bills. I just think that's smart economically. It's smart politically. That comes out of the relationship we have. That comes out of 70 years of cultivating a role on the world economic stage. You know, if you look at Iraq, there is enormous progress being made right now in Iraq on the ground, pushing ISIL back and out of much of the country. The challenge this last 6 months was that the economy of Iraq could collapse even if ISIL left. Again, we were able to work with the IMF to be the foundation for an economic support package for Iraq. And I go into Congress and made the case and thankfully got Congress to approve in the last budget just a few weeks ago a loan guarantee for the United States to do our part, which again is just a small piece of a total package that brings the world together to say we're going to make sure that Iraq's economy has a chance if they make the reforms they need to make, which they're now making. You know, this is economic policy, but it's also a question of our national security.
National security issue.
Absolutely.
But on this issue of financial stability, you didn't do that by yourself. Your predecessors didn't do it by themselves on the world stage. They had to get people in a room, for instance, at the G20.
Absolutely. I think if you look at the G20, the role that I've played over these last 4 years has been on many levels to try and press the world community to come closer to standards that we already meet, and in some cases to use it as a kind of a bootstrap to help ourselves accomplish goals that we want to accomplish. So, for example, if the only well-capitalized banks in the world were the U.S. banks, it would leave an enormous amount of risk in other places, and it also would lead to a competitive disadvantage because of the lower standards elsewhere. The race to the bottom is a big risk in a world, in a global economy. We've used the G20 and the Financial Stability Board, the FSB, which is an outgrowth of the G20, to try and take the kinds of standards that we pursue in the United States and have them be standards that other countries subscribe to. We've done it in a range of areas at different levels of technical detail. But we've also used it as a place to take issues that are not financial stability issues, but are the kinds of economic policy issues that could lead to kind of destabilizing policy conditions. For example, exchange rate policy. We've been in a world where exchange rates have been of great concern in a lot of countries. And the risk of a currency war, which could destabilize the global economy, has been real for many years. We've used the G20 and the G7 as forum to get the major economies of the world to agree to abide by rules that we basically have prescribed, that are, you won't intervene to gain unfair advantage. You won't surprise other countries of the world by taking independent action without warning. And one of the interesting things about these global environments, these international meetings, is the detail of what you agree to matters, but the process also matters. If you agree not to surprise each other, what does that mean? It means you have to call up somebody you know and say, I'm about to do something that is unfair. It hasn't happened since we had that agreement. And it doesn't mean it's 100%, but in a world where you lead by moral suasion, where the tools you have are as much bully pulpit as they are kind of, you know, statutory kinds of authorities. It's enormously important for the United States to be looked up to in the world so that you can play that role. I can tell you that when I started going to these meetings 4 years ago in the current role, I've gone to them in other roles and over the years, but it was the tail end of the financial crisis. The sense in the room was still, you know, you're saying all these things, but how did the United States get us into this mess? By the second year, with the United States economy doing better than other economies in the world, with the resilience of the American people showing itself to be what it is, the questions kind of shifted to how did you do better in your recovery than we did? And you know where the United States leads best? The United States leads best when people want to follow our example. And if the world wants to be like us, it will be a better world. If the world starts to look at us as not caring what anyone thinks and everyone goes their own way, that's a more dangerous world.
The U.S. economy, as you point out, improved on your watch. Was it like 75 consecutive months of job growth? But we know many people are being left behind in cities, rural places, places that used to have more factory jobs. It's persistent. People are upset about this. I don't know, is this an economic question or a philosophical question, Secretary Liu? But is this something that you ultimately have been left feeling is resistant to policy, the economic dislocation that people feel?
You know, David, I think that there's multiple things going on at the same time, and there are contradictions that are hard to explain. If you look at the simple economic facts, having created 13.5 million private sector jobs, having gone from an economy that was losing 700,000-800,000 jobs a month to gaining almost 200,000 jobs a month, it's a swing of a million jobs almost. That means that there are 13.5 million people working who wouldn't have been working if the economy hadn't improved. It should leave people feeling a little better than they feel. You look at what's happening underneath that. Wages have been going up. We saw in the last jobs report, year on year, the best wage growth in a very long time. We saw in the current population survey that poverty has gone down faster than in any other measured period. So at a macro level, you look at the statistics and you can feel pretty good about where we were 8 years ago and how far we've come from there to now. On the other hand, there's clearly a great deal of anxiety and I would say anger, not just in the United States, but in much of the developed world. And you have to ask, why is that? I think that it's complicated because some of it has to do with the globalization that makes people fear that their jobs are going somewhere else. But that same globalization has also led to economic growth, the biggest reduction in poverty, and to more affordable prices for people in a lot of the countries that are feeling that anxiety and anger. I think there's some other things going on, two other things in particular, that are not just a question of the business cycle. One is the role of technology. You know, and we've all seen it in our day-to-day lives. We see it in our home lives. We see it in our work lives, in our offices, people not doing jobs that they did when I started working in the 1970s and 1980s, whether it's outside your office answering the phone and typing and copying, or whether it's on a manufacturing floor, you know, doing the work of producing things by hand.
Technological unemployment, robots ate my job. It's that concept.
Well, but you know, you look at the rate of change. It's given us the ability to get more done. It's given us the ability to have more things in our lives that provide value. I mean, the people don't waste a lot of time figuring out where to go. They just punch a few keys on their smart device, and they save themselves a half hour or an hour of wandering around. You could say that we've reached a golden age of people having tools, that are available democratically to everyone. The question is, what does it mean about the structure of the economy and what does it mean about the workplace? And there, I think there's, you can break it down into pieces. If you're a manufacturing worker who's worked for 20, 30 years on a production line, it's not that likely that you're going to go out and become a computer programmer. You know, if somebody tells you that, they look at you, rightly with a skeptical look. But it doesn't mean that person can't do any other work. One of the reasons we talk about the need for infrastructure investment is the kind of work that goes into building things is not that different than the kind of work that goes into factory work. If we put the investment into building up our infrastructure to meet the challenges of the 21st century, we would create more jobs for some of those people who are feeling dislocated by the technological change. For the future, it's different. For the future, the question is, what skills do we give to our children and our grandchildren so that the next generation has the skills to take the advantages of technology and take it to a higher level with more value-added work that they can do and the wages and the security in life that go with that? But there's another component, and that is, as you see technology come into the workplace, you're also seeing a shift that the rents, the benefits of economic activity are more going to those who own the capital and less to those who provide the labor, because the input of capital and labor are shifting in terms of what the composition of the economy is. Now, we have something to do with that when we make tax policy. And the question you have to ask as we make tax policy is, are we rewarding capital over labor? Should we be doing things to make it easier to have a middle-class lifestyle on a working wage and perhaps tax the earnings on capital in a way that is more reflective of the benefit that goes with having the high earnings that go there? You know, I obviously think we should. We've made proposals along this line for a number of years. It's not as if we haven't seen this coming. But that politically is hard to do. You have to be willing to take on interests that, you know, like the fact that you can have, you know, very economically advantageous investments, whether it's in high technology or real estate, and pass on the gains from generation to generation with virtually no tax. At the same time, you go to work at minimum wage, and your first paycheck, you're paying Social Security and Medicare at $1.01. And when you ask, why do people say it's not on the level? Well, I think what I just described is what they, at some level, intuitively know. Now, I'm not so sure that we're at a point where this debate is going to be joined the way I just described. My fear for the next year is that this is a moment where, you know, and I've seen this twice before in my career, where in 6 to 9 months you can make decisions on fiscal policy to cut taxes and to create a future fiscal path that puts more and more pressure on the things that are vital to middle-class Americans, things like Medicare and Medicaid and education benefits and nutrition benefits. I think that the questions that have to be asked as Congress makes policy over the next year is tax policy going to help or hurt in terms of rewarding working families versus those who already are quite well off? Is it going to create a fiscal hole that puts pressure on the things that are so important to working families? And if you can't answer those questions, a yellow light ought to start blinking, because what we learned in 1980 and what we learned in 2001 is you make the decisions quickly and they have a long tail. It takes a decade to go back and repair the things.
All right. You're a young man still, a bit early for Social Security for you, even the early version of Social Security. Anything to announce yet on the career front for you?
No announcements yet, but, you know, I'm proud to have had 8 years of service at a level that, you know, one could only dream of when I started out in this line of work. I'm proud of what we've had have to show for it in terms of our accomplishments. I look forward to spending some time doing some teaching and some writing and to thinking about the future in the comfort of living in the same city as my wife again after 8 years of commuting.
Jack Lew, U.S. Treasury Secretary, for about another week here. Secretary Lew, thank you.
Thanks so much, David.